You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So we're going to be looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1 through 11. And I would say that this chapter can really be summarized by what life means under the sun. I think it would be appropriate for us maybe just to read through our entire passage and then maybe go through it verse by verse. So let's begin. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1 through 11. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all of their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning to its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea seems never full. To the place the streams come, from there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear is filled with hearing. But what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which we can say, look, this is something new? It has already been done long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Why, some of you may be asking, is this even in the Bible? What is the point? I think it would be helpful for us to go through this maybe from the very top, verse 1, and try to break this down a little bit. So the first verse is the words of the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Now, this word teacher is the Hebrew word koheleth. And the koheleth comes from the Hebrew word kahal, which means an assembly or a gathering. And so when ancient people translated the Old Testament into Greek, they translated this word ecclesia, which if you are familiar with the Bible, if you've been studying it for some years, you'll realize that this is the same word that's used in the New Testament for assembly and actually is synonymous with the word church. So the koheleth, the teacher or the instructor or the preacher, as it's sometimes translated in certain texts, is somebody who gathers an assembly for the purpose of instruction. And really the koheleth is there to push you to the logical conclusion of your views. As you can see, one of the things that really stands out whenever you read the book of Ecclesiastes is just how negative the koheleth is. And this is part of his strategy. One of the things he wants to do is he wants to take your worldview, your presuppositions, and he wants to drive them to their logical conclusions to see whether or not you're living consistently with them, and to help you come to a place of realization and understanding of who God is. Now, there's actually strong evidence that our teacher is King Solomon, who wrote in the 900s BC. Now, of course, a lot of skeptics of the Bible question whether or not Solomon wrote this, in large part because they believe that this book was written much later in the 300s BC. But again, there's a number of pieces of evidence that suggest that this was actually Solomon. First of all, we read in verse 1 that it was the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, we know that there were many kings of Judah who followed David. So it may not be Solomon, but again, there are other breadcrumbs throughout the book of Ecclesiastes that leads us to believe that this was actually Solomon. We're told in our chapter, verse 16, that the koheleth increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before. And this would match exactly Solomon, who we know was the wisest man who ever lived on earth. There's this incredible story in 1 Kings chapter 3 where God came to him in a dream as a young man, probably in his early 30s. And God said, listen, I'll give you whatever you want. Just tell me. Can you imagine if God gave you a blank check and was like, anything you want, anything at all? I'm sure a lot of us would end up with some pretty ridiculous things. But Solomon said, I'm just a young man, and if you look at this vast kingdom that you've given me, I don't have the discernment and the knowledge to be able to rule your people. So give me wisdom beyond my years. And God was so impressed with Solomon's request that he says, I am going to make you the wisest man who's ever lived, the wisest person who's ever stepped foot on earth in the past, and the wisest person who ever lived. And in addition to that, because you didn't ask for riches and fame and great success, what I'm going to do is I'm going to lavish that upon you. You are going to have riches beyond comparison. All the nations are going to look at you and envy the great splendor of your kingdom. And so Solomon was an incredibly wise person, but he was also a man who enjoyed incredible wealth. He enjoyed pleasure beyond measure. And really, this is part of the reason why Solomon is writing this book. A lot of people think that Solomon wrote Song of Songs. If you ever read that book, it's pretty spicy. Get the blood going, the juices flowing. Solomon wrote that really in the spring of his life, and a lot of people actually believe that he wrote Proverbs, which is Hebrew wisdom, after this event in 1 Kings chapter 3, as he gained incredible wisdom, and then toward the end of his life, as he's looking at the final balance, the ledger balance of his life, looking back on all of his accomplishments, that he wrote Ecclesiastes. We're told in verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Koheleth uses the word havel, which in Hebrew means something like emptiness, futility. Sometimes it's used as a wisp of smoke or a vapor. And so he's using this word picture to try to help us to see what life is like under the sun. That it's utterly meaningless. You know, it appears in one moment, and in an instant, it's gone. It's kind of like you see a vapor cloud filling a room, and just like that, it's gone. And yet, there's still traces of gummy bear in the air, and you don't know why. And he says, that's your life under the sun. If this life is all that there is, then life is utterly meaningless. It's just a vapor that's going to soon disappear. He says in verse 3, what do people gain for all the labors at which they toil under the sun? This right here is the controlling question of the entire book of Ecclesiastes. Every single word contains significance. And I want to spend a little bit of time trying to dissect this question. The first thing he says is, what do people gain under the sun? What does he mean by this life under the sun? Well, the teacher, who is not like your normal teacher who instructs you in math and science or English. Instead, this teacher is more like a professor of philosophy. And he's asking tough questions that's leading you to conclusions instead of simply supplying the answers for you. And so he says, look at this life under the sun. And the way that he's analyzing life is he's saying, if you look at life as if there is no creator, or maybe there is a creator, but he's distant, largely uninvolved in life. Imagine life from the perspective of a functional atheist. Somebody who is not looking to meaning above the sun, but is trying to create meaning in her life by the things that she does. That is what life under the sun is like. Peter Greer, who wrote a book on Ecclesiastes, explains this. He says, Ecclesiastes is basically a crazed experiment in staring at the sun and describing how badly it hurts. Life, what's the point? Does any of it have any meaning? But it's not nihilism. It's not the assertion that nothingness is everything. Kohelet simply knows that if you have to face the meaninglessness of your self-made life before you can find meaning from another source. So he writes from a perspective under the sun, under the glaring light and the relentless heat of our earthly grind. He invites his readers to forget, for the sake of argument, what life looks like with an intimate relationship with God. Instead, concentrate on this life, just this life, as if that's all there is. And so he's running a thought experiment, saying, imagine if this life is the only life there is. There isn't any life above the sun. How do you gain real meaning from your life? Does your life matter? Is there any sort of purpose? And he says, what do people gain? That's an important question. We ask that question about practically every aspect of our lives. What's to be gained by this work or this activity that I'm doing? You know, imagine if I walked up to you and I said, hey, I want you to take this ball and I want you to bounce it 594 times. And you'd be like, well, why would I do that? And be like, just don't worry about it. Just do it, okay? It'll take you a few hours. It's not a big deal. And you'd be like, no, I'm not going to do that. You need to explain to me what's to be gained by me bouncing a ball 594 times. I'm not going to do that. And so we approach individual pieces of our life this way, where we ask the question, what's the purpose? What's the meaning? What's to be gained by what I'm doing? For example, a lot of us would say to ourselves, if I can gain wealth, if I can get more money, then my life will be happier. And to some extent, that's actually true. We know that once you get to a certain household income, that your well-being does increase. But beyond that, there's actually diminishing return. And so you go from eating spoonfuls of peanut butter for lunch and eating packets of ramen noodles as a college student to then being able to afford a decent meal somewhere, and your life gets better, right? You gain a little bit of weight. You're a little bit healthier. You may be a little bit more marketable. But I think the trap that we fall into is that if I can only get more, if I can have more, if I can gain wealth and have the things that I want, then I can create this sense of identity by the things that I possess and the status that I can hold in life. Michael Norton, who is a professor at Harvard, a business professor, asked more than 2,000 people who have a net worth of at least $1 million or more. And according to the study, there were people who had vast sums of money, far exceeding $1 million. How happy they were on a scale of 1 to 10, and then how much money they thought they would need to get to a 10. He concluded, all the way up the income wealth spectrum, basically everyone said they needed at least 2 to 3 times as much to be perfectly happy. 2 to 3 times as much. Imagine if you were sitting on $2 million. You wouldn't even have to worry about money at that point. And yet, according to his data, you would think you would need 2 to 3 times as much just to be happy. One of the things that he noticed was that happiness was relative. That they were happy relative to those who were impoverished, but to their peers who also were wealthy, there was a lot of competition. There was a lot of comparison that caused them to feel that they weren't as happy. And so a lot of these different pursuits that we give ourselves to, we think to ourselves, if I can only gain that thing, then I'll be happy. Then my life will have real meaning and purpose. And the Koheleth challenges that view, as we'll see throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Again, Greer says, at one point, Koheleth says that God has placed eternity into our hearts, a universe-sized expanse that would swallow the entire world if it could, and that yet it would still be hungry. That's true in our experience. Many of us lived that way before we knew Christ. Many of us are living that way right now, where we're consuming pleasure. We're consuming experiences. We're trying to gain as much wealth and trying to gain as many possessions as possible. And yet, even though we get that thing that we think is going to finally make us happy, that next iteration of the iPhone, it just wasn't as good as the first time you got your iPhone. It's just never the same. And so we find ourselves feeling that sense of inner hunger that seemingly nothing can satisfy. Then he says this. This is an important word in the question. He doesn't just say, what do people gain for all of their labors at which they toil under the sun? He says, what do people gain for all of their labors at which they toil under the sun? All of their labors. You see, the average person would say, you know, I'm not a philosopher. I don't ask these big questions in life. But an average person like me lives for the here and now. It's the things that I do day to day that really impart meaning into my life. You know, when I'm driving down the road with my windows down, it's a beautiful day, and I'm listening to music. That fills my life with meaning. When I hug my boyfriend or my girlfriend or a loved one, that's when I feel meaning. When I decide to do something compassionate for somebody who's hurting instead of doing something selfish, that's when I feel real meaning. And yet the problem is we look at these individual parts of our life in relationship to others, and yet we're failing to ask the bigger question, what's to be gained by all of this toiling and all of this labor that we do under the sun? You know, you're really refusing to ask the question, what's to be gained by all of this toil? And you know, the reason why we fail to ask that bigger question, what is the overall purpose of my life, is because we're afraid that if we ask that question, it's going to shatter our sense of meaning, that we're going to descend into despair. Because if the conclusion we arrive at is that there is nothing past this life, that this life is all that there is no other meaning under the sun other than the life that we create and the meaning that we create here on earth, then we find ourselves in a place where we are inconsolable. You know, imagine I had a friend and I drive down his street and I see that he's in the middle of a street taking a rock and placing it on a large pile of rocks in the middle of the street. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm building a large pile of rocks. And I'm like, well, why would you do that? And he said, well, I want to put this lantern on top of this large pile of rocks. And I'm like, well, why would you do that? And he's like, so that cars who drive down this street can see that there's a large pile of rocks. You see, he is finding meaning in individual parts in relationship to others. But he's failing to ask the bigger question, does all of it make any sense? Or is it just plain stupid? Why do you work? Well, I work because I have a lot of hobbies. I enjoy lots of leisure. I like to travel. Well, why do you do that? Because it recharges my battery. Well, why do you do that? So that I can work. You see, the lantern is for the large pile of stones, and the large pile of stones is for the lantern. And the question we fail to ask ourselves, does all of it make any sense? Or is our life simply stupid? Is it utterly meaningless? You see, I think the person who is an optimistic naturalist would say, there is no life under the sun. Everything is utterly meaningless. But I do believe in human dignity, and I believe in moral right and wrong. Listen, if your origin came from nothing and your destiny is to nothing, then have the guts to admit that your life is nothing. Do you see the utter opposition between those two views? Either there is a life above the sun in which your life actually does possess meaning, or there's nothing to your life, and all we have is what's under the sun, in which case your life has no meaning. And while we're at it, let's stop trying to poke holes and inconsistencies in other people's worldviews. You call out the Muslim person who has a drink of beer, or the Christian who isn't neighborly toward his neighbor. We poke all these holes and try to point out all of these inconsistencies in other people's views, and yet we fail to look and examine our own views. Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous existential philosopher, says, God does not exist. And we have to face all the consequences of it. The existentialist is strongly opposed to certain types of secular moralism which seek to abolish God at the least possible expense. What he's saying there is, we like the idea of getting rid of God because he no longer has control over my life. He no longer is going to come and impose himself on me. And yet, we don't want to get rid of the other things that come with the belief in God. He says, existentialists, on the other hand, find it extremely disturbing that God no longer exists. For along with his disappearance goes the possibility of finding values in the world. There can no longer be any good since there would be no infinite and perfect consciousness to think of it. Nowhere is it written that we must be honest or that we must lie since we are on a plane where there is only us, human beings. Dostoevsky, the famous Russian novelist, once wrote, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. That is the starting point of existentialism. You see what he's trying to say here? If God does not exist, things like moral distinctions evaporate. Things like significance and meaning that you try to create in your life vanish. So we can't get rid of God and cling on to the things that come with a belief in God, that there's true life under the sun. So Sartre basically took this idea that there is no meaning in life and that there is nothing other than life under the sun. And he basically said, listen, we need to just basically get rid of these things that have shackled us. We need to be free from this belief that God is real and that we're bound by morality. Now, what came up later on in Jean-Paul Sartre's life was that he was actually a misogynist, that he would mistreat women. And, you know, whenever I read people who agree with his philosophy and yet look at the way that he treated women and cringed, I imagine Jean-Paul Sartre, who is only 5'2", rising up and saying, you want to be free? You want to be free of these moral distinctions? You want to be free of this idea of God? Then you need to have the guts to get rid of this idea that there are things like moral right and wrong, human dignity, your significance. And you need to conclude the fact that life is utterly meaningless if God doesn't exist, if all that there is in life is what's contained under the sun. You know, Christians look like hard-nosed skeptics compared to the person who says, I believe that life is totally meaningless, yet I'm optimistic. I believe that there's good and evil. I believe that people should be compassionate. Talk about blind faith. Well, the question is, why is Koheleth doing this, right? Why is he giving us a beatdown in Scripture? Well, what's interesting is that when you look at the first two chapters of Ecclesiastes, there's no mention of God. It comes up at the very end of chapter 2. And, you know, it does come up a little bit in verse 13, but that's where God says, or where Koheleth says, God has laid such a terrible burden on man. So it's not really a positive thing. But God comes up at the very end of chapter 2. And so why is he doing this? Well, I think he's running a thought experiment. He's saying, what's left of life if all there is what's under the sun? And the answer is nothing. There's nothing there. And you see, if God exists, then this sense of existential despair that we feel from knowing that our lives are utterly meaningless, if this life is all that there is, that truly is a gift from God. To drive us to this point. You know, it's a gift from God to get rid of all of your defense mechanisms. Because in your despair, there are all types of pointers to God. And some of us know that just on an experiential basis, where we have gotten to the lowest point in our lives, and it was only then that we started to question our lives and ask the bigger questions, and to actually explore whether God is real. You know, C.S. Lewis said, "How could an idiotic universe have produced creatures whose mere dreams are so much stronger, better, and subtler than itself?" He says, do fish complain of the sea for being wet? Or if they did, would that fact itself not strongly suggest that they had not always been or would not always be purely aquatic creatures? You know, why are we so uncomfortable with a world where the strong eat the weak? Where, you know, people die, where people take advantage of one another? Why does that bother us if this is all that there is? And what we're seeing is natural selection playing out as it should. Why does that bother us? It suggests that maybe there's more. And that's really what Koheleth is trying to do. He's trying to drive us to this place. Well, let's keep reading. Verses 4 through 7. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. So what is he saying? What has been, always has been, and will be. So what is he saying? He's saying, hold on to those skinny jeans. They're coming back. Whether or not you're going to be able to fit in those in 20 years, God knows, right? And, you know, when you look at this way of life, you know, I think when you wake up in the morning, I think a lot of us look at that and think, wow, look at the brilliance of the sun coming up. You know, some of us feel a sense of pleasure and joy from seeing that, or the sunset. But, you know, for the person who Koheleth is trying to describe, the sun is another reminder. The sun rising is another reminder of having to work in the salt mines. Every setting sun is just another reminder that our lives are moving toward our eventual death. And so this really represents sort of a relentless grind that we feel, where it's this constant repetition of lather, rinse, repeat. He says, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear is filled with hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was already here long ago. It was here before our time. Now, of course, I'm sure that if we had Solomon here today and we showed him the new iPhone 13, was like, check out this. This is called TikTok. I mean, that would probably blow his mind. He would have never envisioned that. And yet what he's saying is that in essence, the things that humans do from generation to generation really never change. There's nothing new under the sun. This is interesting. Cycling has come up with a new technology. This is called the shaft-driven drivetrain. And on Ceramic Speed's website, they market this as purchase a piece of history. And this is pretty cool because actually, you know, the cassette or the cogs on the back of the wheel there are actually 3D printed from titanium. The base price, the entry level to get into this drivetrain, I'm not talking about the whole bike, just the drivetrain, $2,000. And so you look at that and you think, oh my gosh, it's amazing. I can't believe that we would invent something so amazing like this. And yet, here's a bicycle from 1899 that was a shaft-driven bicycle. There's nothing new under the sun. I was thinking a little bit about marketing, and I remember back in the 90s and even further back than that, they would have product placement, right, where you would do a TV show, a famous celebrity, and then in the middle of their show, they would do a product spotlight, and they would say, you know, Winston cigarettes goes down smoother than any other, and, you know, they would actually smoke the cigarette on set. And that was how they marketed their stuff. And I remember in the 90s, there was sort of a movie that kind of captured this, a scene.
Listen, we need to have a talk about Vanderhoff. The fact is, he's the sponsor. And you signed a contract guaranteeing him certain concessions, one of them being a spot on the show.
Well, that's where I see things just a little differently. Contract or no, I will not bow to any sponsor.
Sorry, you feel that way, but basically it's the nature of the beast.
Maybe I'm wrong on this one, but for me, the beast doesn't include selling out.
Garth, you know what I'm talking about, right?
It's like people only do things because they get paid. And that's just really sad.
I can't talk about it anymore. It's giving me a headache.
Here, take two of these.
Ah, Nuprin. Little. Yellow. Different.
Look, you can stay here in the big leagues and play by the rules, or you can go back to the farm club in Aurora. It's your choice.
Yes. And it's the choice of a new generation.
I'm sort of dating myself by this example. This is Wayne's World, you know, where they basically had cable access TV show. And, you know, these producers basically pitched them on having a big show, and obviously it was monetized. What's interesting is that this was in 1992, before the internet got really big. And once the internet, you know, came online, you would get email marketing, you would get online ads. And so basically this whole idea of product placement was just totally foolish. I mean, that's just the thing of the past. And yet here we are full circle where podcasters and, you know, social media influencers are constantly doing product placement. There's nothing new under the sun. It's the same old thing. Well, he wraps up and he says, no one remembers the former generation. Even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. So he puts sort of a really depressing summary on this whole thing. You know, I was walking on the Freedom Trail in Boston in October, and one of the things that my family saw was this cemetery called Copps Hill. And this cemetery, I think, was established in like the mid-1600s or late 1600s. And what was crazy is when you went into this cemetery, you know, some of these headstones were so thin, they were like fragile shale. And you could tell they had been worn down so much that even the inscription was barely legible. And you think to yourself, these people, many of them were successful. Many of them believed that they had so much meaning and purpose in their lives. Many of them were surrounded by people who loved them. And yet all trace of who they are is slowly disappearing. And that is what Koheleth wants to communicate to you. If this life is all that there is, then all trace of who you are is going to vanish one day. But there is a positive thing that he says in this book. He says, he really tries to push us to the utter brink of despair, but he offers an alternative. In chapter 12, verse 1, verse 6 and 13, he says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble came and the years approach when you'll say, 'I find no pleasure in them.' Remember him before the door to life's opportunities is closed and the sound of work fades. Here now is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey his commandments." To fear God means to have reverence, to acknowledge his presence in all that you do. In essence, what he's saying is, live your life for him and you will experience meaning to the fullest. It's not going to be something that you artificially manufacture. It's going to be something that God gives to you. And so when you experience pleasure, you can enjoy it because you're not staking your life on it. It's a gift from God. When you gain money and financial stability, you can enjoy it because you're not crafting your life around that. You know, if you've never placed your faith in Jesus Christ, then this book is urging you to do that without delay. Why? Because you can gain as much money, gain as many things as you want, to try to gain as much success as you possibly can. And yet without God, your life is going to be completely futile. Jesus says this, "For what shall it profit a person if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Here's the thing. This life is not the only life worth living. God says that there is eternal life, a life that we can live beyond this one, that gives this life true meaning and purpose. And the way to experience that is to turn to God and receive the gift that Jesus Christ purchased on the cross. Also, Solomon experimented with life and discovered that there was no lasting satisfaction in possessions, pleasures, power, or prestige. So be a vicarious learner. You don't have to do what he did and then look at the end of his life and think to yourself, I wasted my life living for myself. And finally, if you face doubts about God and his existence, consider what it is to be gained from life under the sun. I know this might be surprising to some of you who are Christians, but occasionally Christians have doubts. And that's okay. All of us experience that. Some of you are wrestling with doubts about God's existence. You know what's been a really helpful exercise for me is to sit down and set out in paper what would disappear if God didn't exist. And that always drives me back to the fact that God has to exist. Otherwise, my life is an utter contradiction. There you have it. Ecclesiastes 1. And next week, we're going to be talking about the pursuit of pleasure. So, stay tuned. Yes, we know that our world is filled with many people who are feeling a sense of despair in their lives. And we know that you weep over those people, that you feel deep compassion for them. And we know that when you do speak to us through books like Ecclesiastes, that your intention is not to hurt us or to make us feel bad for the sake of feeling bad, but that you're doing this because you love us and you want to show us that you're real and that you want to impart true meaning into our lives and relieve us from this feeling that we have to create meaning in our own lives. I pray for those of us, Lord, who are at this place, that they would just call out to you and express that they feel this utter despair. And I pray that they would ask to see whether or not you would reveal yourself to them. And we know that you're faithful to do that because you are real, that you are a God who exists and who does speak. And I pray that they would have an encounter with you this week. Pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.